it's very important that the community get involved at an early stage of these cases and start asking the questions that they should ask.
Uno, dos, tres.
Yo, what's up, fam? From Futuro Media and PRX, it's In the Thick, a podcast about politics, race, and culture. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Joining us from Brooklyn, New York is Julian Harris Calvin, director of the Greater Justice New York program at the Vera Institute of Justice. Hey, Julian, welcome to the first time that you're on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Very excited to be here with you all.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And joining us, yes, from Philadelphia, PA, the one and only, the fabulous Luis Suave Gonzalez. With an S.
With an S.
Artist and former juvenile lifer, star of the Suave podcast. What's up? What's up, bro? Welcome back to the show.
I'm honored to be in the presence of greatness.
Man. Okay. All right.
And Julian accepts that.
Yeah, it's definitely Julian on the show.
Yes, you are welcome.
I love it. I love it.
So remember, people, that everybody is still basically recording from their homes. So if you hear weird noises in the background, it's because we're still figuring out how to survive in COVID without getting it. So we're recording from home. All right.
Yeah.
So we just want to acknowledge, dear listener, there's a lot going on right now. You know,
yeah.
Twitter is being bought by Elon Musk. There's what's happening in Ukraine. There's what happened in France. There's just a lot.
Yeah.
Today, though, we're going to be talking about something that really matters to all of us, and it has to do with prisons and the criminal legal system. Now, remember, we don't call it criminal justice anymore because that's kind of like, huh, that's on the assumption that there is justice. It is, in fact, factually correct to say we are talking about the criminal legal system.
Mm.
So think about that as you change your vocabulary.
Yeah.
Now, this is something, obviously, that Julian, you and Suave are both very touched by. Julian, you're a former public defender. Your current work deals with criminal justice advocacy and how structures around bail, sentencing, and parole need to change, right? That's the next part of the conversation. Mass incarceration has long tentacles. Suave, you know that firsthand because you have been part of the criminal legal system. You were incarcerated for over 30 years. But what we're going to do first is, you know, we love this part of ITT. It's a chance where we get to do a check-in. So, Suave, I actually haven't talked to you in a little bit. So, Suave, how you doing? Like, how you doing? What's your temperature check? How you feeling?
I don't know yet. I'm at community college, overseeing 200 students, enjoying this job, enjoying my freedom, and ready to get deep into this conversation because I like that. The criminal legal system is still broken. It's still not being fixed.
Okay, but can you answer my question?
Yeah, how are you feeling?
How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm healthy. I'm taking care of myself. I'm fasting. And I'm just happy. I'm in a place where I'm happy in life.
Okay.
All right.
We love to hear that, Suave. And how about you, Julian? What's your temperature check? How are you feeling?
Thanks for asking. I'm doing pretty well. Mondays are hard for me. I was just telling a friend of mine who's in town for a couple of days and staying at my apartment. Monday is just not my best day. Takes me a little time to get the momentum of the week. So I'm glad that I'm able to kind of just hang out and chat with you all and, you know, be in a chill space talking about something I'm passionate about and not having to write some legislation right now.
Just taking a break.
Wait. They didn't tell you that to be on the show, you had to write some legislation.
Yeah, where's your bill?
I mean, I'll write one, but on Tuesday, just not on Monday.
That is the best answer ever.
Yeah.
I am going to write a bill. I'm going to write it on Tuesday, all right?
Exactly.
I'm showing up with the bill tomorrow.
Wait, don't underestimate me.
Do not underestimate my power. That is greatness right there.
I'm glad we're laughing, right, Julio? Because we got a little bit of good news, right?
There's actually surprisingly good news. And to kind of frame this conversation, you know, the story that we've been following in Latino USA, which is the case of Melissa Lucio, who was the first Latino woman to be put on death row in Texas. And she was scheduled to be executed this week on Wednesday for the death of her daughter. But on Monday, speaking about Monday, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals granted Melissa Lucio a stay of execution, meaning that she would not be put to death on Wednesday, which that is a big deal.
It's not like this is weeks.
Right.
She was going to be put to death by the state of Texas on Wednesday. This is a matter of 2 days before her life was going to be taken by Texas.
Hours.
Yeah, hours, literally, yeah.
And this is after increasing calls from family, advocates, even a number of jurors from her original trial were saying that she needed a retrial because of evidence that her daughter's death was an accident and not murder, right? So a major factor in her sentencing back in the day was the police interrogation and Melissa's quote-unquote confession, right, which her lawyers say was coerced. After 5 hours of questioning, you know, and this is a mom, right, during which Melissa maintained her innocence over and over, she eventually said, "I guess I did it." That was the quote. "I guess I did it." So our producer, Harsha Nahata, spoke to Victoria Law, who's a freelance journalist focusing on incarceration, about the gender dynamics behind Melissa's sentencing. Let's take a listen.
First, the prosecutors leaned very heavily into this idea that anything that happens to a child is a mother's fault. And then we have the false confession that Melissa Lucio made after she had been subjected to a 5-hour interrogation. And on the trial's opening day, and again during their closing arguments, prosecutor played recordings of her statements that said that she was responsible for the child's injuries. They leaned on the fact that Melissa Lucio was not crying and screaming and acting hysterical in the ways that they thought, or they wanted the jury to think, that a mother who is grief-stricken about her daughter's death should be acting. Her seeming passivity, which a domestic violence expert could have explained as a reaction to decades of abuse, instead was a sign of her guilt. So what we're hearing again and again is that this trial was rife with the prosecutor leaning on gendered insinuations about what a good mother is and how a good mother should have reacted. And because Melissa Lucio, who was poor, who was Latina, and who had a flat affect because of years of abuse, did not meet those ingrained ideas as to what we think a good mother is, the prosecutor was able to make this case that she was responsible for her daughter's death.
I mean, this is just another case, another example, right, of how policing is at the root of criminal, you know, the criminal legal system, and incarceration is just the final step. So, Julian, you being a public defender, can you talk about these systemic issues within the criminal legal system? And how have you seen this play out specifically in Melissa Lucio's case?
I think what is most apparent, as we just heard in that clip, is that she is obviously a woman of color, and women of color are often stereotyped as bad mothers, though we're often the people taking care of other folks' kids, which is interesting.
Exactly.
But when something goes wrong with someone under our care, whether it's our own child or an elder we're caring for, or we're caring for someone else's sick relative, because we are stereotyped as bad mothers, we are often the automatic suspect in a case. And that is exactly what happened here. As we just heard, the night her 12th child, this is our youngest kid, 2-year-old, was found dead, she fell asleep and did not wake up, the police automatically suspected her and completely ignored any other evidence to the contrary. And so this is just something that we see constantly. Black and brown people are considered suspect. We're considered dangerous. We're considered inadequate when it comes to caring for our own kids, when it comes to morals and values. And that is what happened the moment the police were called to the scene, when, you know, the hospital personnel automatically suspected her. And then the police came and automatically suspected her.
Right.
And then we saw that the medical examiner automatically suspected her. And all of those players, because they saw this poor brown woman with too many kids, right?
Yeah.
They disregarded evidence to the contrary and said she must have done it, and we're just going to get her to tell us that she did.
So, Suave, you have been interested a lot since you've gotten out in looking and following the case of how women behind bars are treated specifically. But just in case anyone who's listening to ITT doesn't know or didn't listen to the IDA documentary award-winning.
The award-winning documentary podcast.
As per the IDA.
Hello.
If you didn't hear it, so Suave, you were actually sentenced when you were 17 years old.
Yes.
And how that sentencing happened, I think, says so much about what happened in Melissa Lucio's case. Just like how this shit happens.
Yeah.
If you are alone and traumatized and you're being raked over by the system.
Yeah.
So you're sentenced at 17. You were sentenced to life without parole. You spent over 3 decades of your life incarcerated. I meet you when you're in your first decade. And if it wasn't for actually a Supreme Court, right, decisions like Miller versus Alabama in 2012, Montgomery versus Louisiana in 2016, both of these found life without parole sentences for juveniles to be unconstitutional. And had this not happened in the Supreme Court, you would still be behind bars.
Right.
But you have been on the other side of this. And I'm thinking, as you're watching the Melissa Lucio case, one, how you're thinking about this in terms of this particular case of her gender. And the state of Texas, you're right, Julian, does not really like people who are not white. If you're poor and white, they don't like you too. But if you are black or brown, if you speak with an accent, if you are poor,
yeah,
you know, you are.
Everything's against you, like in Texas.
Yeah. And it's borne out. It's not where, like, we're making this up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So on the one hand, Swabe, there's that question. But also what your sense is about the role of outside advocacy in terms of the outcomes.
I mean, for Melissa, it started when the paramedics was called February 17, 2007. I researched this with the white paramedic that made that observation. It started with her right there and then when he said, oh, she's not reacting to the death of her child. Well, guess what? My grandfather got killed in front of me and I ain't shed a tear. I ain't even react. Did that make me the killer? No, because somebody else killed him. In terms of activism and community being involved, I always say this, and I'm going to keep saying this. If you are black, brown, in the state of Texas, you have no win. You have no win at all. So it's very important that the community get involved at an early stage of these cases and start asking the questions that they should ask and not just buy into the narrative, well, she must have did it because she's Latina or bad. My mother has 6 kids. Did that make them bad mothers? No. No, absolutely not. The problem that we have in our community is that we don't understand the legal system, right? We don't understand that system, right? We don't understand law. So when we get into these rooms, they cuff you up to a metal chair, they deny you water and food or whatever else, and you sitting in that chair for 16, 17 hours. And they ask you questions and you say, well, I must have did it. They take that as a confession. That is not a confession.
Right.
You know, I sat in a chair for 26 hours cuffed up as a juvenile without being given permission to see my mother at all. Hmm. But the difference was that I understood. I watched a lot of TV and my hatred tossed the police at that time was so deep that I said, I'm not saying nothing till I see a lawyer. Unfortunately for me, I didn't see a lawyer. So I was arrested and charged. But again, the charges in my case, like Melissa's case, was upgraded because a medical examiner said, well, he must have shot him close range. Well, guess what, medical examiner? I wasn't the one that pulled the trigger, you know, but since I was brown and have no resources to fight these allegations, we got to bite the bullet. And that's what happened in Melissa's case. As a woman in Texas, she has no win. And it's ironic that Texas is supposed to be the home of the first integrity unit. You know, the integrity unit is supposed to be there to research and investigate allegations like that happened in Melissa's case, and it didn't happen.
So the thing about it, and thank you for that, Suave, the thing is what happened with Melissa Lucio, and she definitely caught a break, and that is because of the kind of activism that has been happening in the state of Texas and nationally. And another place where there was attention drawn because of the conditions, which are horrific, but also because of the activism, deep, deep activism, is the humanitarian crisis at Rikers Island, the jail complex in New York City. So over a year now, conditions at the jail have been worsening. There are staffing shortages that are leading to increasing violence. There's people, thousands, who are facing medical neglect. In 2022, this year so far, three people have died in custody at Rikers. And in 2021, 16 people have died. That's the highest recorded number since 2013.
Wow.
Now, those are deaths, my dear listener, that do not need to have happened. Those 16 people in 2021, the three people in 2022, they should be alive.
Yeah.
And this is a shame on this city and on the entire country. Now, last week, Damian Williams, a U.S. attorney in Manhattan, raised the possibility of a federal takeover of the jail, something that's known as receivership, if the city failed to take dramatic systemic reforms to deal with the crisis. I'm like, they've been talking about the need for systemic reforms for decades. So
yeah, that's like ongoing.
So former mayor Bill de Blasio vowed to close Rikers down in 2017, and the complex is planned to be shut down by 2027. It will be replaced by four smaller facilities. Okay. Current mayor Eric Adams, who is a former cop,
yeah,
is cracking down on what he's calling, you know, this sense of rising crime in the city. And this could lead to more arrests and incarcerations at Rikers, which, you know, is there's no space. In a recent episode of the Epicenter NYC podcast, Lizandre Cadu spoke about her son, Stefan. He's one of the 16 men who died at Rikers last year. Let's take a listen.
They're not animals. They're humans. And they have a family and people that love them and care for them. And it's not right that they should be treated that way. And on my son end, like I say, he had an expectancy to live to 70, 80. He could have become the president. He could have did anything that he put his mind to. And the fact that the system there is designed to mess these people up, inhumane system, caused my son to die.
And there you have it. And Julian, you know, a lot of people who take the inhumane system even larger, right? Because the people who are held at Rikers, many of them are being held while they're awaiting trial. So this is not prison, right? It comes jail first, and then you are sentenced to prison. When you are in jail, you are there awaiting trial. And that's because you can't afford bail.
Correct.
So let's just break it down for people. Mm-hmm. What role does bail reform and rolling back bail, what does this have to do with Rikers and writ large?
That's a very nuanced question, which I appreciate because I think people want simple solutions to complex problems. And that's why we have mass incarceration. So thank you for wanting to have nuanced conversation about
absolutely
nuanced problems. So to get to your question, at its height in the 90s, Rikers Island had 20,000 people incarcerated on Rikers Island.
Oh my God.
In the spring of 2020, that population had plummeted to 3,800 people, which is incredible. And that plummeting population is the result of multiple factors, one of which is that we have seen crime rates, arrest rates, and incarceration rates decline dramatically in the last decade. So all three of those things helped get us to a lower jail population at Rikers Island,
right,
when we got to 2019. In 2019, the state passed historic bail reform. And what that means is that people who are charged with a crime, as Maria mentioned, can be held on what's called bail. And bail is a dollar amount that the judge says you have to pay in order for you to get released from jail and be able to fight your case from home. So you pay, let's say it's $10,000. The judge says you have to pay $10,000 in order to get out of jail. If you don't pay $10,000, you sit in jail until your trial or until you are convicted and sentenced and shipped off to prison. And so if you have the $10,000, great, you get to go home, you go back to your job, to your kids, to your education. And though you still have the troubles that come with, you know, a criminal case pending against you, you don't have all the disruptions of being held pretrial. But if you are held pretrial, that means you go and you sit in jail. You might lose your home, your education, your child custody, any income, any of your assets you have, not to mention just the trauma of being caged for months or even years on end. And so what the legislature said in 2019 is it isn't fair that Julian, can't afford to bail herself out. So she has to sit in jail and have all of those consequences and more that I just mentioned. But Maria, she can afford it. And she's charged with the same thing as Julian. She has the same history as Julian.
Wow.
But because Maria has $10,000 or her grandma can put up her house mm-hmm. as collateral for that $10,000, she gets to go home. She doesn't lose her mm-hmm. job. She doesn't lose her children. She doesn't lose all of these things.
Wow.
And so the legislature in 2019 said, that is not fair and it's not okay. And so what we want to do is limit the use of bail as much as we can so that we're not seeing these huge disparities where you could pay your way out of jail and others can't. And we saw racial disparities that are aligned with that too. It was mostly Black, mostly brown,
right.
mostly of color or poor people who can't afford their way out of jail and have to suffer. So they passed bail reform in 2019, which basically said, if you're charged with almost all misdemeanors and most nonviolent felonies, the judge cannot set bail for you. They have to release you, and they can give you conditions of release, like maybe it's clear that your alleged offense arose from a drug addiction,
right.
or you have mental health issues, or you need help with employment, or you need help with housing, or you just need to have someone who is monitoring you and assisting you to stabilize you. So you can have what are called pretrial release conditions, but the judge cannot set bail on you.
Wow.
And then for the rest of the offenses, which are felonies, mm-hmm. and mostly what are classified as violent felonies, even though they might not actually be violent in the lay sense, an example of that is like burglary. I walk into the vestibule of your apartment, steal your package. That is actually considered a violent crime, but they can set bail on that. And what we saw between 2019 and the summer of 2020, we saw our jail population just plummet dramatically. And that's how we got to 3,800 people. And so that's amazing. But even before bail reform went into effect, just after it passed, we saw this coordinated effort to blame bail reform for rising crime that wasn't even happening. And so there was these pro tough on crime, pro law enforcement voices that were creating this rhetoric in the news media that the news media picked up, didn't fact check, and reiterated in the public narrative. So by the time we got to April of 2020, there were bail reform rollbacks that the state legislature then passed, widening the number of cases or the kinds of cases that could have bail set. And we then saw that narrative taking hold against what we think are judges and prosecutors and other folks. And we saw the jail population start to tick back up beginning in the summer of 2020. So now the population at Rikers
is going up.
Is about 5,500. And that's when we were seeing this massive humanitarian crisis happening on Rikers Island.
Wow. Can we just say for a second?
Bravo.
That was exactly the context I need, because I do think
we needed it.
Yeah, because people look at the headlines and it's like Rikers and oh, things are going to change and bail reform and all that in New York State. And in the end, there's always something more complicated. But Suave, after your release, you're still under lifetime parole.
Yes.
What does that mean?
No, I'm never going to be a free man, you know.
Right, right.
I'm never going to be 80 and be free from the system, because a lifetime parole means that I got to constantly check in with my parole officer. I got to ask my parole officer if I want to go to New York, if I want to cross city limits, county lines, I got to ask for parole. If I want a new job, if I move on to a new job, I got to ask them for permission.
Yeah, so you're checking for everything.
I mean, in my view, if you're on lifetime parole, you're not a free.
Exactly.
Man. And let me make something clear. The better the job, the more you pay for your supervision fees.
Oh, wow. So you're still part of the system, right? You're in the system. What are you seeing? And how do you see the crisis at Rikers given your perspective with all the things that you're going through right now?
The crisis at Rikers Island remind me of when I first came to prison. This is how county jails are. I went to a prison called Holmesburg, which was like the worst prison in Philadelphia.
Right.
And it was the same exact thing. You slept in a room, like 50 people in one room, one toilet, shit all over the place. And, you know, people angry. So that create violence. We took our anger out on each other and we took our anger out on the guards and made it unsafe for the guard. It was unsafe for us. We're going to make it unsafe mm-hmm, for you. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing. It's a human condition.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, I always say America is infatuated by this kind of stuff, because we're talking about reforming the system, right? But we turn our our head away from what's going on in Rikers Island. And a lot of the time, the people in Rikers Island, I haven't even been found guilty yet. They're just detainees.
Right.
They haven't been found guilty of no crime yet.
Yeah.
So they don't deserve that kind of treatment.
Can I just interrupt and say, I know that
go ahead, Julian.
We make it a point to say that these are people who are held pretrial. They're not even convicted of anything. But even if they were, this is not the kind of constitutional treatment folks should be getting. No one should be failing to get medical care because they committed a shoplifting. Nobody should be starving or being forced into fight clubs or being beaten down by correction officers because they've committed a crime. So yes, it's an added like, and by the way, they're not even convicted. But even if they were, this is not how we conduct business in the United States. This is a modern day gulag. And I think it needs to be painted as such.
But this is not a new problem, though.
It is not.
This has been happening for decades, not only in county prison, but in state prison. The only difference now is that we have social media mm-hmm. and we have more people paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
But this is decades of neglect.
Yeah. From Futuro Media and PRX, Latino Rebels Radio is an award-winning OG Latino podcast covering stories of the Latino experience that matter in the United States, the Caribbean, Central America, South America, and even parts of the universe. Lo que sea. Created for, about, and by Latinos, join us every Thursday by subscribing to Latino Rebels Radio wherever you get your podcasts. So what's happening at Rikers, and Suave said it, Julian said it, you said it, Maria, it's just the latest example. I mean, this is a pattern. It's ongoing. It's unchecked,
mm-hmm.
right? And then the pendulum swings when you hear, you know, obviously when you look in the national political landscape and also, you know, let's not forget the 90s, everyone.
Yeah.
You know, let's not forget the Democrats and not forget the crime bill. And let's not forget, like, the way people looked at people like Suave mm-hmm. in the 90s.
Yeah, the super predator mentality that they put out there.
Exactly. Right. So we know it's this ongoing, unchecked issue. It is part of America, right? The ugly stain of America. But we all know why it's the ugly stain of America, because a country of white supremacy
mm-hmm.
based on incarceration, a history of it. The system's a system, right? And we know that it's had devastating impact on people's mental and physical health. So I just want to share one example of many. You know, an investigation by ProPublica, the Marshall Project, and NBC News looked into the abuses of a juvenile lockup in Louisiana, where conditions were so awful, teens tried to escape by crawling out through holes in the wall. Think about that, right? And we know the impact on kids is so devastating that it was a major factor in the Supreme Court's decision that life sentences for juveniles is unconstitutional. So, Suave, I mean, you know, you were in the Pennsylvania correctional system for decades, which has the highest number of juvenile lifers. And now, like we said, you're under lifetime parole and your freedom. It's not even freedom. It's exactly what you said. You have to check in to parole boards. You have to, like, have your life constantly monitored. And there's no option for appeal for that. So talk to me, Suave, about how incarceration has impacted you and how you work through that now, even after release. I mean, how many years has it been now since you released?
I'm going on 5 years in November.
Yay!
5 years in November.
Yay!
And how has it been, Suave? I mean, seriously, like...
I mean, I'm still... It's like I always tell Maria, I'm just beginning to feel a little bit like I'm out. Because when you constantly under the scope of parole, it's like you can't really move. It's like you in the cell, and when they holler count time, you got to stand up for count. That's how it is with parole out here.
Yeah.
Like if I go to a nightclub, or if I talk to somebody that have a criminal background, if that parole agent want to be an a-hole, I could get violated.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I move from job and don't inform parole, that's a direct violation. If I get a car, I got to let parole know I got a car. Here's a copy of my license and registration, right?
Yeah.
These are the type of stuff that make the average person, you know, like, fuck it. I'm not going to do shit. I'm going to just do what everybody else does. which is go in and out, use the prison system as a revolving door. But when you do good, you don't get rewarded for being good on parole. Mm-hmm. If anything, you get punished. I went from paying $10 monthly fee to now I'm paying $60.
Wow.
Because you have a job that has a bigger salary, and so they're taking more of your salary. I mean, right. It's crazy. Right.
And so, Julian, I mean, your thoughts with Suave's saying, but also let's add the pandemic to this. Mm-hmm. Let's add all the things that have happened over the last couple of years where this system, this incarceration system, I'm sure a lot of things have gone unchecked. I mean, let's be real. I mean, I don't think like health factors play, you know, if you're barely getting minimal health care outside of a pandemic. I mean, what do you think has been the reactions recently in the last couple of years with all this?
Yeah. So what we saw during the pandemic was an initial effort. We saw it in New York City, but I think we saw it across the state and other states as well, where there was some effort to get some people out who had a high likelihood of having negative effects of COVID. But then we saw very quickly that once the first couple months of the pandemic passed, and we realized that we were going to be in a pandemic for a while, that when we looked at the congregate living setting of people who are in jails and prisons, the reaction to that compared to, let's say, the congregate living settings of folks who are in nursing homes or in rehabilitation homes, that they were very different responses by our government leaders and policymakers. Yet people in prison tend to have similarly consistent and problematic health conditions that people who live in nursing homes have. The population of folks in jails and prisons with severe health conditions, even when they're coming in, is higher than the general population. And then, like you said, they get there and the medical care there is inadequate at best.
Yeah.
And oftentimes it's actually detrimental to a person's health. So we have the population already inherently sicker than the general population. Then we have, as you said, the medical services inherently worse than what the general population gets. And then we have the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic in what is a congregate living setting. And then we have people can't get masks, they can't get cleaning supplies, they can't get health care. They're sick outs, like on Rikers Island, the correction officers just decide they don't want to come to work. So we don't even have enough corrections officers to get people from their unit to the little bit of care that they can have.
Right.
And what we were seeing is that COVID took a much greater effect on folks in our jails and prisons than in the general population for all of those reasons. But we did not see a similar response by policymakers. Because again, like you were all saying earlier, you know, when someone is accused of a crime or someone is convicted of a crime, society feels like they are disposable and they are a threat.
Right.
And what happened really is in jails, there's what's called jail churn. So people are often in jails for just 2 days or a week or a few months before they can pay bail or their case gets disposed of. And so what we're seeing is people would go in without COVID, they'd come out with COVID, and then they're spreading it into their communities. And the COs are doing the same thing. They're going in and out of jails all day back into our communities. And so actually, it's harmful for the people who are incarcerated and also folks who are in the broader community. Mm-hmm. And so failing to care for those folks in the jail is failing to care for our broader communities outside of the jails.
Yeah, absolutely. So really interesting thing. Former President Donald Trump had 13 people executed under him. It was one of the highest counts in over 120 years.
Wow.
Joe Biden ran opposing the federal death penalty. Last summer, Attorney General Merrick Garland issued a moratorium on federal executions. So that's like kind of incredible. Mm-hmm. But we just want to do a quick check-in before we end. And we'll start with you, Suave. Do you think that the Biden administration has done enough?
The guy who did the crime bill? This is an interesting question.
I know. You're rating 1 to 10 on Biden and his success.
Yeah, so I mean, like 30, 40 years later, like where he at?
Well, I thank you for that because my opinion of Joe Biden is not hot because I believe that Joe Biden is the reason why that super predator mentality came into place. Him and Hillary and Bill Clinton, they created that. So no, I don't think he has done enough mm-hmm. for criminal justice issue. He ran on this issue, but as of yet, no, I believe he could do more.
All right.
Hello, President Biden, straight from Suave's mouth to your ears. Julian, your sense, just really, what's your take on what President Joe Biden has done and what he needs to do?
Look, he has a lot to make up for. And he has, to his credit, has acknowledged that. But to your question, there is a lot more work to be done by his administration to roll back the harms that were caused by the 94 crime bill. And so this is an answer you don't want to hear, but I think the answer is yet to be determined. I want to be hopeful that there will be more progress than kind of the shaving around the edges that he's kind of doing with his executive authority and to take more of a leadership on like moving progressive criminal justice reform through Congress and onto his desk.
We're going to move on to our final segment because we need to end with a little joy. And this is La Última y Nos Vamos, or the last one before you go.
Don't underestimate my Spanish skills. You don't have to translate for me. Okay.
Damn. I was more our listeners.
No, it wasn't so much for you, Julian.
I know, I'm playing.
Damn.
That was like, you're part of the family now, Julian. You definitely are part of the family now.
Yeah, totally.
Right, now you're going to start talking to me in Spanish. I'll be like, you know what? I don't understand what you just said.
Okay, bring it down. I'm not that great. Okay.
Julian, you made us laugh. I was telling the producer, I was like, we need to end with laughter. So you did make us laugh even before I asked you the last question. But this is the question. Something that is bringing you joy in your life right now.
My nephews bring me joy. I know it's a silly thing to say. They're 5 and 2. Aww. And I just love them so much. And my littlest, he FaceTimes me every day because he's bored all day. So he just like FaceTimes family. I think it's just me he's FaceTiming, but I'm sure it's other people. And he just calls to say, hi, Juju.
Juju?
Yeah. Well,
that's the third one. Because my daughter is Juju. We have Julieta, who is Juju. And now we got Julian, who's Juju.
I love
got
it.
Got a lot of good Juju going on.
Exactly.
All right, thank you for that. Suave.
Oh.
I never ask you this question ever.
Oh, this is good.
What is something that you are doing or something that's happening in your life que te está trayendo un encanto, que te está trayendo felicidad, something that's bringing you joy, Suave?
Oh, my God. Let me see. Something that's really bringing me joy today is every time I've signed a formerly incarcerated person into college and I see them taking classes and showing up, that is the greatest joy that I could have. I just be smiling because these are people that the system counted out and now they're attending college. And I'm just glad that I could be the one, I could be that source for them. Mm. And also driving.
Driving gives you joy?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Can't wait to drive my dear around.
No. Oh, this is going to be interesting.
I drive real slow. So the people would be like, But then I got a sign in my brand new car that say, new driver, please be patient. Right?
Does that help you?
It don't, but it bring me joy when somebody walk by and be like, hey, buddy, go on the other lane. It just give me joy. It's something that I'm doing for the first time in 52 years, which is legally driving.
I hear you.
And you know that the mother in me came out as soon as Suave told me, he said, Maria, I got a car. I got a license. I was like, oh my God, Suave. We need to talk about other drivers, not how you drive, but other drivers. Mm-hmm. And we need to talk about road rage. It's real and you want to stay away from it.
And I do put my seatbelt on. I put my seatbelt on.
Good for you, Suave.
Sounds like Suave causes road rage. I can just imagine myself behind him now. Get the fuck out of the way. Okay.
All right. Believe it or not, I've been cursed out more than once. But I don't even get mad because I'm like, okay, buddy, I'm still going to drive slow. Go around.
No, Suave, you just got to roll by and you got to be like, yo, you got no idea who you're honking at, right, man. My name is Suave Gonzalez with an S, cabrón.
That's right.
Luis Suave Gonzalez, thank you so much for joining us, artist and former juvenile lifer, and Julian Harris Calvin, a.k.a. Juju, director of the Greater Justice New York Program at the Vera Institute of Justice. Y muy bienvenida. Thanks to the both of you for joining Julio and me on this episode of In the Thick.
Thank you.
Thank you, Julio, Maria, and the whole Futuro group. Before you go, Maria, one thing.
Go.
We need justice for Estrella. People need to get involved.
Aww,
justice for Estrella.
Tan lindo. And if you don't know who Estrella is, just look on the Latino USA feed. Suave, thank you for always thinking of others.
Look at you.
Really, that's beautiful. I'm going to tell her you said so. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Uno, dos, tres.
Dear listener, remember you can go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. And this, I would say, is a 10. Like, that was hot. Remember, you can listen to In the Thick on all major podcast platforms now. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends and family to listen. In the Thick is produced by Noor Saudi, Harsha Nahata, Lisa Salinas, and our fellow Sarah Hershander, with editorial support from Charlotte Mangin. Our audio engineering team is Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Gabriela Baez. Our marketing manager is Luis Luna. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records. Special thanks to Motor City Woman Studios in Detroit, Michigan, where Julio is recording today. And we'll see you, dear listener, on our next episode. Remember, no te vayas. Thank you so much for listening. Besitos. Bye.
Detroit in the house. Bye. The veteran Suave Gonzalez.
That's right.
With a S, not a Z. Gonzalez. With a S.
Yeah, we got it, Suave Gonzalez.
That's what we're talking about. Okay.
All right.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees. From PR.